with a time-like vector, you get the flow of energy and momentum, k mu. Remember that in the case where V was a Killing vector field, this was a conserved energy momentum four vector. We proved that. Now, we don't assume that the V is a Killing vector field. We're only assuming that it's time-like. But we can think of this to be an energy momentum four vector, even if it is not conserved. And when it is not conserved, we still want that the energy and momentum, even if not conserved, still flows into the future and not space-like. That would be weird, right? So we kind of accept that energy and momentum may not be conserved. In fact, in general relativity, they're generally not conserved, energy and momentum, right? We don't always have Killing vector fields. But we still want that the energy flows forward in time and the momentum flows forward in time, that it doesn't flow in a space-like direction. So we want that that vector here, the four vector of energy momentum, has negative length, negative or zero length, so that it's flowing either on the light cone or in the light cone. That is what the dominant energy condition says. It says that the local energy momentum flow vector k, even when it is not conserved, has to be non-space-like. This is basically to ensure that we have causality. Otherwise, if energy momentum could flow outside the light cone, chances are that that would violate causality. But now, for the purpose of the singularity theorems, we assume the strong energy condition. The strong energy condition. And the definition is that matter is said to obey the strong energy condition if this expression, in terms of the energy momentum tensor, is larger or equal to zero for all time like xi. But what does that mean? There are two ways to look at this. One is that this is the Ricci tensor, and we will need later in the derivation of the singularity theorem that the Ricci tensor contracted with time-like vectors is always larger than zero. We will see why exactly and where exactly that comes up. But on the other hand, we can see what that actually, we can try to find out what that actually means. What does it mean for the energy momentum tensor that that condition holds? And as I mentioned before, that condition means it excludes matter that causes an accelerated expansion. Let's just prove that. Okay, so what is the condition here? It's that this is larger or equal to zero for all time like xi. Now, we can choose our coordinate system in such a way that the xi is just 1, 0, 0, 0. Right? It's time-like. So there's a Lorentz transformation that will do this. So let's assume it's that. Then what is it we have to prove is larger or equal to 0? Well, then we have to prove that T naught naught minus 1 half, and then we have T rho rho. Now that is minus T naught naught plus, so this is minus T naught naught plus 3TII, or let's say 3T11. We are assuming here that T11 is the same as T22, same as T33, just to keep things simple. And then G naught naught, right? So that's a minus 1, so it's a plus here. So we need that this is larger or equal to 0. I hope I didn't do a mistake in this. So let's assume now that T mu nu, in the case of cosmology, right, this might be rho p p p. Okay? So what we have is that rho plus 1 half, and then we have here minus rho plus 3p, larger or equal 0, right? So that would be rho half, right? Just a sec, 1/2, right? Yeah. So it would be rho half larger equal to minus 3/2 p. Is that right? Yes. Okay, so that means that p is smaller equal to -1/3 rho, right? Now we have that p is equal to w parameter times rho, right? So what we have is that the w parameter is smaller equal to, no, larger equal to -1/3. Larger equal -1/3. Now, do you remember what that means? Remember that the w parameter is critical. If it is -1/3, the universe expands linearly, if proportional to time. If the w parameter is larger than -1/3, then it's a decelerated expansion. If the w parameter is smaller than -1/3, it's an accelerated expansion and it's inflationary. If the w parameter is -1, it's exponential inflation. Right? So this is the threshold case. So what this is saying is it's ruling out the cases of accelerated expansion. Now, is this plausible? Well, it's known to be obeyed by the known forms of matter, but a cosmological constant, of course, could undo this. What is the relationship of the strong energy condition to the weak and dominant energy condition? It's logically independent of them. It's not a strengthening or weakening of them. Concretely, it looks like this. For known matter, T mu nu is diagonalizable usually, and it takes this form. T mu nu is rho p1, p2, p3. This is the energy density. These are called the principal pressures. And then, even though they may not be pressures, right? Because this could be just, a scalar field that is causing this, this energy momentum tensor, and then as such, it doesn't have a pressure. But the energy momentum takes this, energy momentum tensor takes this form, and so we call these the principal pressures, because they occur the same way that pressures occur in a gas, in the energy momentum tensor for a gas. So the energy conditions are then these. The weak energy condition can be understood as saying that the energy density has to be positive, and we also have that the energy density plus the PIs has to be positive for all, for each one of these pressures. Dominant energy condition can be put in this form, and the strong energy condition is this, which is also what we derived over here, except that here we allow the principal pressures to be different from each other. And you can check that these are not determining each other. I mean, yes, the dominant energy condition implies the weak energy condition, but that's it. All right, and here I put it as an exercise to do this. Sorry. Okay. So what we have is that the theorem now claims that the strong energy condition is necessary so that we can show that the geodesics meet a divergence of a quantity called the expansion in finite proper time. And we want to prove that everything is no older than a certain amount. And the strong energy condition, remember, says no accelerated expansion. And forward-looking in time, it means the expansion shouldn't be too dramatically strong, But backward looking in time, it means it shouldn't be too dramatically weak, because it's exponentially weak, the expansion, if you look at it back in time. And if the expansion is too weak, it may not actually induce a singularity. So that is why we need a strong energy condition to force the expansion to be not too strong in the future, which also means not too weak in the past. So the strategy of the singularity theorem is to prove, in order to prove that everything is no older than a certain amount, the strategy is to prove that the so-called expansion blows up at a finite proper time if you run it backwards in time. And the expansion, remember, is one component of what can happen to a bunch of geodesics as the universe is changing underneath them. So the geodesics are traveling along happily, and then the universe expands, contracts, or does all sorts of things. And then that circle of geodesics that we might consider initially might, you know, do this sort of thing, expand or rotate, and so on. In practice, what we will do is we will consider a bunch of geodesics that are not necessarily arranged on a circle, but instead just fill the space. You can think of them as like the geodesics where every geodesic is the geodesic of a galaxy. So then each galaxy is just going on its own way. And in the future, of course, these geodesics are going to travel apart from each other, because the galaxies are drifting apart from each other because of the expansion of the universe. And as we run things backwards, those geodesics get closer and closer to each other towards the past. And we want to show that they collide. So what we will do is we will consider a swarm of geodesics, much denser than just one geodesic per center of mass of a galaxy, but one geodesic right next to the other geodesic, but in the same spirit as with the galaxies, just much more dense, right? So these geodesics run from the past, go to the future, and they trace out the expansion of the universe. And so we fill the universe with these geodesics of freely floating objects, just like the freely floating galaxies, we have freely floating objects. They just fill the universe. We have this swarm spaghetti of geodesics there. And then, instead of looking at the circle of them, we will look at the lineup of them. Okay? So we will we have these, you know, bunch of spaghetti of geodesics, and they're parametrized by their proper time. But then, transversally to it, we will also parametrize across the geodesics. We will introduce a parameter that goes across the geodesics. It's basically a space-like geodesic that connects the geodesics to each other. A straight line there, a geodesic. Instead of the circle, it will just take a piece of a line. And then, along that line, we will track what the neighboring geodesics are doing. Are they going to go like this or like that? Are they going like this? That's what we will do. Now, that was all intuition. Now let's do this concretely. The spaghetti of geodesics has a technical name. It's not spaghetti. It's congruence. All right? So spaghetti in math is called congruence. So let's consider a congruence of time-like geodesics, which all run through our space-like hypersurface sigma, the space-like hypersurface sigma being today, for example, at this moment. And so we have a family, a smooth family of time-like geodesics, something like freely falling dust, where each dust grain could be a galaxy, but we want them to be much, much denser than that. So we parameterize these geodesics by their proper time. These are all time-like geodesics, so it's really, these are travelable by objects, such as dust grains. And so we parameterize these geodesics by their proper time, so their tangent vector field, which we may call xi, is simply d by dt. by d tau, where tau is the proper time of the geodesic. Okay, so we have this spaghetti of geodesics, and they have tangent vectors. And since the spaghetti of geodesics fills all of space-time, we have a tangent vector everywhere, right? At every point, there is going to be a geodesic going through it, and its tangent vector is xi. And so we have this tangent vector field of tangent vectors to this congruence of geodesics. And that tangent vector field can be simply written down as d by d tau with respect to the proper time of the geodesic on which we are looking at the tangent vector field. And since we are parameterizing the geodesics with the proper time, we have that the length of this tangent vector is minus 1. Now, do you remember why that is? Well, because you can always Lorentz transform into the rest frame, and then the tangent vector is just speed of light, comma, 0, 0, 0, right? Because when you're in the rest frame, you're moving all right, but only in the time direction with the speed of light in the time direction. Speed of light being 1, the length of the vector is 1, I mean, minus 1. Okay, but we said, in this whole bunch, whole spaghetti of geodesics there, we're looking at a cross-section, at a line that cuts from one spaghetti to the next, to the next, to the next spaghetti, right? And so we're looking at a geodesic, but a space-like one, that goes from one spaghetti to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, at one point in time. So at one tau, but now we are parameterizing along the geodesics. And that parameter, which counts the geodesics that we encounter, we call S. So let us now consider a one-parameter subfamily of these geodesics. So our family of geodesics that we are considering now is like a one-parameter family of geodesics. They all run in this direction and is parameterized this way. So the family of geodesics has two parameters, the proper time along each geodesic, and the geodesic itself is singled out by the parameter S. So here we have our congruence of geodesics. And now let's look at a line of constant tau here. Then we have the xi vector, which points in the direction of it's the tangent vector to this geodesic. That's xi. And then we also have a vector that points in this direction, that we call eta, which is pointing from geodesic to geodesic to geodesic. So these are lines of constant value of s, the geodesics, and these are lines of constant value of tau. Then we have that the two derivatives commute, d by ds and d by d tau commute. But that means that the corresponding vector fields xi and eta are commuting. This means that the covariant derivative of eta with respect to xi is the covariant derivative of xi with respect to eta, because we assume that there's no torsion in the space-time. Remember? The torsion says, the torsion map of xi and eta, which we assume to be 0, is given by the covariant derivative of eta with respect to xi minus the reverse, minus the commutator of the two. But the commutator is vanishing because these guys are simply these derivatives and they commute. Therefore, we have that these two commute with each other. I should remind you of where this is all going. See, what we want to know is how this geodesic deviation vector is behaving, how this eta is behaving, right? Because the eta is pointing from one geodesic to the next. We want to track what geodesics are doing. Are they going to go drift apart? Are they going to get closer? Are they going to rotate against each other? You know, what is going to go on? And we don't want to do that with an entire circle of geodesics. No, let's just take two neighboring geodesics and let's have them infinitesimally neighboring. That should already contain everything. And the vector eta is pointing from one geodesic to its neighbor. So we want to know its evolution there. All right, so what we have so far is that the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi is the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of eta. Let us spell this out. So we have that the covariant derivative of xi, of eta in the direction of xi, is given by this expression here, right? So we have that eta, the vector eta, is written in a basis of tangent vectors. The basis is, let's say, called E nu, then we have that the vector eta can be written in this form. And the covariant derivative in the xi direction, we can spell out this way, that the xi mu is in principle down here. But remember that we can always pull a function out. And this is just a scalar function. We can pull it out of the covariant derivative. So we have that the covariant derivative in the direction of xi of eta is equal to, and then we did the same trick over here. Now, the covariant derivative acting on our tangent vector field is, of course, given by the action as described by the semicolon contracted with the E nu. So that's just by definition that we go from here to here. And the same thing happened over there. Now, this is true for all basis vectors, so we just have to match the basis vectors here. So we get rid of the basis vectors now, we just get the coordinate function. So we should just rename the betas nus so that we have here E nu and here an E nu, and then we can just drop that and we get this equation here, right? So here we have eta nu, that's this one. And here, if we rename that nu, then we have the xi nu. All right, so we have this equation here, which we can trivially rewrite by giving this thing a name. This is a tensor with two indices. It started out as a contravariant thing, but then we differentiated it with respect to alpha. So now it has two indices, a contravariant and a covariant one. And we can write this as a matrix. Of course, a space-time dependent matrix, let's call it B nu alpha. This matrix defined in this way is going to be super important, because it will describe everything. The expansion and shrinkage, the rotation or shearing of everything. And the deformation of, let's say, a circle of geodesics as well. All of that is encoded here. Why? Well, because this is the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi, which means it's the derivative of the vector that points from one geodesic to the next with respect to time, right? Because differentiating with respect to xi is differentiating with respect to time. It's a time-like vector. So we are here calculating the rate at which the vector that points from one geodesic to the other is changing. And what we see is that this time derivative of eta is given by eta times a matrix. So we need to find out what this matrix tells us here. If the matrix B is zero, well then the two geodesics just stay parallel as they always have been. The time derivative of eta doesn't change, is zero, right? So then the vector that points from one geodesic to the neighboring one is just staying the same. But not if B is non-zero. Then what? So along the geodesics direction, xi, this is the direction in which they travel, the deviation vector eta changes its direction and length by this. This is the rate of change of the direction vector from one geodesic to the next. Now, let us analyze that geodesic deviation matrix. We pull down the two indices and we write it like this. We can uniquely decompose B, just on the, as a matter of linear algebra, we can decompose any matrix B into an anti-symmetric part that will be called omega and a symmetric part, right? Every matrix decomposes uniquely into an anti-symmetric part and a symmetric part. This is the anti-symmetric part, that's the symmetric part. Now, every symmetric matrix can be decomposed into a symmetric traceless matrix plus a symmetric traceful matrix. And that's what we have. That's what we do here. This is going to be the symmetric part, which is traceless, and that is the rest, the symmetric part that does have a trace. The trace is going to be super important because the trace is what can expand and shrink. Everything else can only squeeze and rotate. Now, the anti-symmetric part is easy to calculate. It's just one half of the difference between the two, between B and its and B transpose. But how do we calculate sigma mu nu and T mu nu? Well, before we define them, in preparation, let us define a projector that will be useful later on as well. So remember that psi is d by d tau. It is the direction of time. If you're one of these travelers on a geodesic, for you, tau is your tangent vector, d by d tau, so tau is the time. Now, the vector space r times psi is the vector space of time direction. Now, it has an orthogonal space to it, a three-dimensional orthogonal space of space-like vectors. And we can ask, which matrix projects four vectors into that space, the orthogonal complement to the time. So the space-like vectors that are orthogonal to our time direction. That projector will be called H mu nu. And it takes this form. You may have seen projectors before, for example, in electromagnetism or quantum mechanics, and you may often have seen them with a minus sign there. Let's see why the plus sign is correct here. So the projector onto the orthogonal complement of psi is g mu nu plus psi mu psi nu. Why? Let's check. If this does the proper job of projecting onto the orthogonal complement of psi, then it means that after we've applied the projector on some arbitrary vector, that vector has to be orthogonal to psi. So let's apply our supposed projector onto some arbitrary four-vector W. And then let's see whether this thing is really orthogonal to psi. That's the test, right? Okay, so here we have the vector h mu nu w nu. And then we contract that vector with psi mu and check whether it's zero or not. What do we get? Well, so we have the psi and the w contracting here from the left and from the right. And then we get psi w inner product, right? This is psi g mu nu w. That's this expression. And here we have, on one hand, we are contracting with psi. And on the right, we are contracting with the w. So we get psi psi and psi w. But psi psi, given that psi is a time-like vector, this is minus 1. In fact, because it's a tangent vector to a geodesic parameterized by the proper time, the length of it is minus 1, as we said before. And therefore, this is minus 1. And therefore, the psi w inner product minus psi w inner product is 0. OK, so this is the projector onto this space orthogonal to that. Strictly speaking, we also have to prove one more condition to make sure it's projected. Do you remember which one it is? The square has to be itself. Yes. Okay. All right. Then, now that we have the projector onto the spatial part, the expansion theta is defined as the magnitude of the spatial part of this geodesic deviation matrix, right? Remember that the time derivative of eta, eta being the vector that points from one geodesic to the next. The time derivative of eta is B acting on eta. So B contains everything about the shrinkage and expansion or rotations and squeezings and so on. The expansion is defined to be the magnitude of the spatial part of B. So we are contracting it with the spatial part. As we will see in a moment, it's also the trace of B. And remember, the expansion is what we're really after. We want to show that the geodesics crash into each other as we follow the expansion backwards in time. The expansion that we now see in the universe run backwards in time results into the geodesics crashing into each other. So we define the expansion to be this, and I'll show you in a moment why that is a justified name for it. But for now, let's just look at technically, this is the definition of it, and then we claim that the trace of B is also theta. Now, what is the trace of a tensor? Well, you just contract it with the metric, right? That's the only covariant way you can set two indices equal and then sum over them. You do it with the metric. We're just in quantum mechanics not used to having a metric, so we just do this without the metric. The metric being trivial in quantum mechanics. So what we have is that the trace of B is also theta. Let's prove this. Theta is, by definition, the contraction of B, the geodesic deviation matrix B, with the projector onto the transversal part, onto the spatial part. And let's spell that out. Well, H is G plus psi xi. So theta is B G mu nu, and psi xi B mu nu. And this is what? Well, this is by definition the trace of B, right? It's just set the two indices equal and then sum over them. And here, what do we have? B is, if you remember, is the covariant derivative of xi. So if we now contract that with xi mu, we get the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of xi. That vanishes. Why? Because it's the tangent vector to a geodesic. And for a geodesic, the covariant derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the tangent is vanishing. That's the definition of a geodesic. So that term goes away, and therefore the expansion can be written this way, but you can also replace it by the G mu nu. Doesn't matter whether you choose the H mu nu or the G mu nu. Okay, so now we are ready to write the two remaining terms in the decomposition of B. Oh, how do we get there? Right. Here. So remember, the geodesic deviation matrix, like any other matrix, just on the basis of linear algebra, can be decomposed into an entosymmetric matrix plus a symmetric matrix. And the symmetric matrix can be decomposed into a traceless part and a traceful part. And the entosymmetric part is, of course, this one. And now now we can calculate also the symmetric traceless and the symmetric traceful part. Namely, the symmetric traceless part is given by this. We take the symmetric part of our matrix B and then subtract the trace. So we subtract that bit here. You see, if you take the trace of this, the trace will vanish because you get a trace here. You get it, however, also here with a factor of 3 because you're contracting H mu nu with itself. And so you're just subtracting the trace again. And then the traceful part is just that piece which you subtracted over here. So now we've completely decomposed the geodesic deviation tensor B into an entosymmetric part, a symmetric part that is traceful, and another one that is traceless. Here's the interpretation of the three contributions. We have the antisymmetric part of the geodesic deviation tensor. And because it is antisymmetric, if you remember, it generates Lorentz transformations. But since our eta vectors, the vectors that point from geodesic to the next geodesic, since these vectors are space-like, since they are orthogonal to the time direction, the Lorentz transformations that we obtain in this way are all just rotations, not boosts. So therefore, omega mu nu generates spatial rotations of neighboring geodesics around another. And omega mu nu is therefore called a twist tensor. So you have geodesics that then rotate like this. And one can prove that if we choose the congruence of geodesics to be orthogonal to the space-like hypersurface on which we set the initial conditions, then the omega will be zero. Now, the second contribution to the geodesic deviation matrix was the symmetric traceless part. So this part is symmetric and therefore Hermitian, and we can consider it diagonalized. Remember, it's just a spatial part that matters here, so where the metric is positive definite. So that part is Hermitian, we can diagonalize it. And what does it do then? Well, what it does is it changes the relative lengths of the basis vectors by multiplying them with its eigenvectors. So this means that if you have a circle of geodesics, then they can be squeezed and stretched. These circles of geodesics can be squeezed and stretched. In one direction, you might have an eigenvalue that is that is larger than one. In another direction, you might have an eigenvalue that is smaller than one. However, since the trace of that matrix is zero by construction, we have that if we exponentiate the action of that matrix, because remember, the time derivative of eta is equal to the matrix B, in this case the sigma part of it, times eta. So the time evolution leads to an exponentiation of it, because the time derivative is proportional to B times eta. Time derivative of eta is B times eta. If you exponentiate that to get a finite action of this deviation, then because sigma is traceless, you have that the determinant of that finite action is 1, which means that the volume is being preserved. And what that means is that if you start out with some circle of geodesics, then if you compress it in one direction, it has to expand in the other direction. You cannot get an overall magnification of it. A circle of geodesics will not overall get bigger or overall get smaller. So sigma is therefore called the shear tensor. So far we had rotations of geodesics around each other. We had a shearing like this. And the last part is, of course, the expansion. So the twist and the shear tensors are traceless. Well, we showed it for the shear tensor, but for the twist tensor, that's trivial, because the twist tensor is antisymmetric, so therefore it has all eigenvalues zero. I mean, it has its diagonal is zero, so therefore its trace is zero, and therefore it too is a volume preserving. But the last part in the geodesic deviation tensor B is the expansion tensor, given in this way. And it has a trace, and so it is therefore capable of generating an expansion or contraction of nearby geodesics. Now we are ready to study the evolution of theta. to study how the distance between geodesics behaves over time. Remember, the situation is we, as a condition of the singularity theorem, we assume that everywhere in space-time, at a point in time, such as now, so on a space-like hypersurface, we have that the space-time is expanding at least a certain finite amount. And now we want to run the evolution of the space-time backwards in time and follow a congruence of geodesics backwards in time, where we expect that they get closer and closer together. And the challenge, of course, is to calculate what can happen even without knowing any details. Remember, we are not assuming isotropy or homogeneity. We are not actually solving the Einstein equations here. And still, we want to draw some generic conclusions, such as about the existence of a geodesic, for example. So how can we do that? How can we draw general conclusions without knowing exactly which are the initial conditions, just for a class of initial conditions? Okay, so what the singularity theorem is claiming is that the expansion theta, which describes how geodesics approach each other or diverge from another, that this, when run backwards in time, encounters a divergence at a finite proper time in the past, which will then mean that there was a Big Bang singularity. Okay, so let's remember the setup here. The setup is that we have a congruence of time-like geodesics running through the present time, sigma. So we have a smooth family of time-like geodesics, exactly one through each event of the present moment. Then, remember, we considered a one-parameter subfamily of these geodesics, parameterized by tau, the proper time, along each geodesic, and s, which ran from geodesic to geodesic. So these green lines are the geodesics, and then the black line is a line of constant tau value. Then we defined the geodesic deviation vector eta that points from one geodesic to its neighbor. And what the singularity theorem claims is that what happened in the past is that this geodesic deviation vector here went to zero. So there was a sudden expansion out of a point. These geodesics merged in the past. So there was a Big Bang singularity. So what we need to calculate, therefore, is how this geodesic deviation vector changes along a past-directed time-like geodesic. So we take one of those geodesics to the past with tension vector psi, and we calculate how eta changes towards the past. Remember, what we found is that the rate of change of that geodesic deviation vector, so the derivative of the geodesic deviation vector eta in the direction of time, which is to say in the direction of psi, so this is the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of psi, we found that this is given by eta times this geodesic deviation matrix, where the geodesic deviation matrix was given like this, and we decomposed it into its antisymmetric, symmetric traceless, and symmetric traceful part. So along the geodesic side, the deviation vector eta changes its direction and length by this, at that rate. And the decomposition of that geodesic deviation matrix was this one, as I mentioned. And explicitly, just to collect everything that we have, all the material together, explicitly, the antisymmetric part of the geodesic deviation matrix produced twists, which is to say, if you have a circle of geodesics, it gets rotated. So your bunch of spaghettis goes like that. And then you have the sigma, which is the traceless symmetric part, which does a shearing. So the area doesn't actually change. You compress in one direction, it has to expand in the other direction. And then we have the volume changing part given by the expansion, where you can actually make a circle of geodesics bigger or smaller. And theta here was the trace of B. And H was the projector onto the orthogonal complement to the time direction. So the key question we now have to address is, what is the dynamics of theta, especially towards the past? Except if we want to consider the future of a universe, and for example, the future of a contracting universe. Now, for this, we will have to kind of solve the Einstein equations. But we can't, because we don't know what the initial conditions are. So we will derive what is called the Ray-Chaudhry equation, or whichever way that properly has to be pronounced. And that equation is instrumental for describing the dynamics of how geodesics behave under the evolution. Not just in the cosmological context, but also in astrophysics, when you study the collapse of matter into stars. Then similarly, you have that a bunch of geodesics contracts. And in order to study that, you use the Ray-Chaudhry equation. So both in cosmology and in astrophysics. So the Ray-Chaudhry equation, how do we get that? We will use, on one hand, that the definition of the geodesic deviation matrix as the covariant derivative of the tangents to the geodesics. We will use the curvature tensor, or Bethe Ritchie equation. Remember what that says, right? It says that if you parallel transport this way that way, or this way that way, the Riemann curvature tensor tells you by how much a vector is rotated differently, whether you go one half of the parallelogram or the other half of the parallelogram. And in order to derive the Ray-Chaudhry equation, we will use that xi is tangent to a geodesic, which is to say that the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of xi is vanishing. And that is, of course, the statement that, you know, in terms of the coefficient functions, it's the statement that the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of xi is vanishing. This is just a quick rederivation of it. Okay, so now let's calculate the rate of change of B along the geodesic. Remember that if we have the B, then we have the expansion, and we have, you know, the shear, and we have those local Lorentz transformations, the twist. But what we are now aiming for is the time evolution of these, right? What is the time evolution of the expansion? What is the time evolution of the shear? What is the time evolution of the Lorentz transformations, the twists? So in order to calculate the time evolution of that geodesic deviation matrix, we calculate its time derivative. So we calculate the action of the tangent vector in the time direction of the geodesics. So this is the covariant derivative of B in the direction of the future of a geodesic. Here I wrote which of the assumptions go into the derivation. So A was the definition of the geodesic deviation matrix, B is the Ricci equation, and C is the fact that we're dealing with geodesics. All right, so first of all, by the definition of A, of the matrix A, we have this expression here, where it means covariantly differentiated in the direction of B and of C. And then we use the Ricci equation, namely this one, but we put this on the other side. So now we have that this is equal to those two terms, because the equality of these two terms are equal to that is exactly the Ricci equation. Now we use the Leibniz rule. We basically integrate by part without the integrals. It's just a Leibniz rule. So if you take that expression and covariantly differentiate it, you get two terms. One is the covariant derivative of the first term, leaving the second the same, and then another term where you leave that the same and then covariantly differentiate the second term. So if you do this, then you get two terms. One where you covariantly differentiate this term, leaving that the same. That's what we had over here. But we also get a term where we covariantly differentiate this and leave that the same. That term we didn't have up here, so we have to subtract it, and here it is. And this is just carried forward. But this term is vanishing because we're dealing with the geodesic. Xi is the tangent vector field to a geodesic. So that thing is vanishing. So we are just left with these two expressions here. And now we can plug in B again, because this is just the geodesic deviation matrix, and that is the geodesic deviation matrix. So we obtain this here. In summary, we derived that the time derivative of the geodesic deviation matrix is given by minus BB plus all of this. And if we take the trace of that equation, we obtain here the time derivative of the expansion, right? And we get the trace of all of that stuff as well, of course. But the point is, the trace of that equation is the Riemann-Chaudhry equation. But before we do this, let's remember what we should expect. Xi is the time derivative, tau being the proper time along the geodesic. Then the trace of B is by definition this. It is what we call the expansion. So the trace of the left-hand side of this equation is simply d by d tau of theta. So this, the trace of this here is simply the time derivative of theta, the expansion. Now the right-hand side of this equation here is a little more complicated, but we can work it out. We simply have to put the expression for B that we derived in terms of the antisymmetric part, the symmetric traceless, and the symmetric traceful part, plug all of that in here, and we get nine terms. No, these three terms occur here and there, so we get nine terms here. Here they are, nine terms. Now it turns out that because of that decomposition into an antisymmetric part, a symmetric traceless, and a symmetric traceful part, we have that under the trace, these three parts are orthogonal to each other. Under the trace, the product of the antisymmetric and the symmetric is vanishing. And also under the trace, the product of the traceless and the traceful part is vanishing. So therefore, when we take the trace of these nine terms, only three will survive, namely those where we have the antisymmetric times the antisymmetric, the symmetric times the symmetric, and the symmetric traceless times symmetric traceless, and the symmetric traceful times symmetric traceful. Only three terms survive. and they are these. So the trace of this BB term up there is given by these three terms. So therefore, the Ray-Chowdhury equation is given by the time derivative of the expansion being equal to these three terms, and I'm just rewriting them here, and that term that also arose in the derivation of the time derivative of the geodesic deviation matrix. Now what we see here is that the time derivative of the expansion is minus a third expansion squared. Now, no matter whether that thing is positive or negative, the square is positive. So that thing is negative. So the expansion drops. Now here we have that this is always positive because it's a square. And this thing is also always positive. In fact, we can also choose it to be zero by choosing the space-like hypersurface, by choosing the initial congruence of geodesics to be orthogonal to the initial space-like hypersurface. And then we have the last term, which also comes with a minus sign, but it's the Ricci tensor contracted with the geodesics, with the geodesics tangent vector. But is this positive or is it negative? It's going to be important. Because if we can prove that this is always negative, then we have a chance to prove something important about what the evolution of theta will be. But if it can be negative and positive, can we prove? Now, it is at this point that this business comes in. You see, when Hawking, Ellis, and I don't know who else first came up with these calculations, when they arrived at this point, they thought, well, now what? Is this going to be positive or negative? So they said, let's just make an assumption about this. Let's simply assume that this thing is also going to be positive, so that's negative. So that is negative. Let's just assume that that's the case. And then they said, oh, but it's not good to make assumptions about the curvature of space-time when you want to prove something about the curvature of space-time. So they said, that's the Ricci tensor. We can rewrite this. We can rewrite this as saying that, so instead of saying that the Ricci tensor contracted with xi xi is positive, we can also say that t mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu t psi mu, psi nu, positive, right? That's the same. By the Einstein equation, that's the same. And that's the strong energy condition, right? So that's how the strong energy condition came about. It came about because we need to have a definite sign here to be able to draw, to have a chance to draw any conclusions about the dynamics of theta. Now, later, of course, it turned out that the strong energy condition has some interpretation. Right? The interpretation being, as we calculated here, that we should not have inflation. Right? So, at least in the case of homogeneity and isotropy, this condition is equivalent to requiring that the W parameter is larger or equal to minus a third, which means that the space-time is not expanding in an accelerated way. And remember the intuition behind it? The intuition was that if the universe is expanding in an accelerated way towards the future, then it did so in the past, but accelerated into the future, accelerated expansion towards the future means more and more dramatic expansion in the future. But by the same token, the reverse side of the coin, backward in time, it means that the expansion was exceedingly harmless towards the past. Right? It just crept to becoming harmless and more harmless expansion in the past. So harmless, in fact, that it avoids a singularity. Now, as we discussed earlier, in the case of the sitter inflation, for example, there is no singularity at the beginning, right? It's just exponential expansion, and you can run that exponential expansion backward in time as far as you want. No singularity. So indeed, this is important. It is important to impose the strong energy condition in order to fix the sign here that everything is negative over there. This rules out accelerated expansion. And then we will be able to draw conclusions. But not if we have matter that would have a W smaller than minus 1/3. Now, we don't know of any matter of any kind that would have a W smaller than minus 1/3. It's only a cosmological constant and vacuum energy that can do this. But all sorts of regular matter cannot do it. Anyway, so we assume here that the strong energy condition holds, which means that in the early universe, it was not vacuum energy or cosmological constant dominated. Then what can we conclude about the dynamics? All right. I have a slide for it. So if we assume that this term is also positive, so that minus of it contributes negatively, just like all the other terms, then using the Einstein equation, which, remember, can be written in this way, we are assuming that the strong energy condition holds. Therefore, if we assume that the strong energy condition holds, then we can conclude the following, namely that d theta by d tau plus 1/3 theta squared is smaller or equal to 0. Why is that? Remember we had d theta, let me just show you the equation. There we go. Okay, we have d theta by d tau, the rate of change of the expansion is minus 1/3 theta squared, and then minus something, minus something, minus something. All of these terms being negative. We can also write it in the following way. D theta by d tau plus 1/3 theta squared is equal to stuff that's negative. Which we don't know in detail, right? We don't know what the time evolution exactly of this stuff is. But we know this is positive, this is positive, that's positive. So the whole stuff here is negative. So we can turn this at least into an inequality now. By putting this on that side, we can write d theta by d tau plus 1/3 theta squared is larger than 0. So we obtain it's smaller than 0. Sorry, it's negative, right? All the terms on the right-hand side are negative. Okay, so assuming the strong energy condition, what we have is that d theta plus 1/3 theta squared is smaller than 0. These were the shear terms and the term that came from the strong energy condition and the antisymmetric term that did the Lorentz transformations. Okay, but we have this inequality here. The point being that even though we don't know exactly what the initial condition was, we know that just on the basis of the few assumptions that we made, the expansion must have that behavior. Now, that can be slightly rewritten. We can divide that equation by theta squared. That's not going to mess with the inequality because it's positive. So we can write it like this. Now, we multiply the whole equation by minus 1 in order to get that expression here that flips the sign. And then we can write minus 1 over theta squared d theta by d tau as d by d tau of 1 over theta. Okay, it's just a little trick. If we differentiate that, we get minus 1 over theta squared d theta by d tau, which is this expression, right? So this is the same as that. And this 1/3 we can put on the other side. So what we obtain is that d by d tau of inverse of 1 over theta is larger or equal to 1/3. That means that the rate of change of 1 over theta is at least 1/3. Now let's consider two cases, the case of an expanding universe or the case of a contracting universe. The contracting universe case obviously is not that important, but the same math allows us to do that as well. So in the case of a diverging universe, what we have is that at the initial time, like today, where we set the space-like hypersurface with the initial conditions, we have that the expansion is larger than zero, at the extrinsic curvature. We assume that it is larger than zero at the initial time. In the case of a contracting universe, you would assume that the expansion is smaller than zero, which means that the geodesics actually get closer together. Right? If the expansion is positive, geodesics drift apart. If the expansion is negative, then the geodesics get closer. The vector eta either gets longer or it gets shorter. Then what? Here are the crucial conclusions. Here's the time axis, and t naught is the time of the hypersurface on which we pose initial conditions, such as today. And then, in the case A, for an expanding universe, it looks like this. Today, we have that the expansion is positive, right? That was the assumption, that the expansion is positive. So theta of today is a positive value. So here's today, and theta is a positive value. It's here. But remember what we derived with all that work that we did. We derived that this condition holds. The time derivative of theta inverse is larger than 1/3. So whatever the curve theta inverse of tau is, the slope of it has always to be steeper than 1/3. Okay? So we don't know what the slope of the theta inverse curve is, 1 over theta curve is, but it's got to be having a slope larger than 1/3 everywhere. So we know that the theta inverse of tau curve at the present time is here, because that's the expansion we observe now. We also know that this curve always has a slope that is at least 1/3. And this line here is meant to indicate the curve of slope 1/3. So if a curve has a slope that's larger than 1/3, as it must have, then it must be somewhere here, right? Slope larger than 1/3. So if we follow this curve backward in time, such that it always obeys the condition that we derived, such that its slope is always larger than 1/3, then it means that this curve must go like this. It must stay under that curve, right? It must stay under that curve. Otherwise, if you wanted to go above that curve, well, then your slope would have to be shallower than 1/3 at some point. So you cannot get, so the theta inverse of tau curve cannot go above that black line. It has to stay below. But if it stays below for early times, it means that it has to hit the axis somewhere. Right? It has to hit the axis somewhere. Which means that theta, that 1 over theta goes to 0. Right? So 1 over theta goes to 0 at some point in time. some point in proper time of the geodesic, because tau is the proper time of a geodesic. So there has to be a point in time, proper time for the geodesic, tau Big Bang. There has to be such a time in which theta inverse is zero, which means that theta is infinite. Right? So where we have an infinite divergence of the geodesics. And that, of course, births the framework of the differential geometric description of general relativity. That's where we cannot follow the geodesics any further. So that means that theta inverse of tau must have hit theta inverse of tau equals zero at finite time in the past. So we have a cosmological singularity. Cosmological singularity because that's true for all of the geodesics, not just one. Or not just a few, but for all of them. Which is to say that everything has a finite age. And we can calculate what the maximum finite age is. Namely, simply by calculating how far that is away. Right? Because that's the latest that it could be, or the earliest that it could have been. And that's what the theorem said. It's C third, where C is the amount of expansion that we had initially. That's if the curve stays directly on here, if the geodesic stays directly on here. And similarly, if we have a contracting universe, then we can carry out the exact same calculations and the same arguments. And then what do we have then? Well, then we have at the present time, if we were in a contracting universe now, then at the present time, we would have an expansion that is negative, and therefore also 1 over the expansion would be negative. So at the present time, tau naught, we would have some negative expansion, therefore some negative 1 over theta. And then again, we still have that the slope of the curve has to be larger than a third, steeper than a third. But if you have to climb steeper than a third, well then you cannot go shallower. You cannot prevent hitting the axis at some point. So at some point, this curve must intersect the axis, for example here, at tau BC, BC standing for Big Crunch. So if the universe met the conditions of the theorem, including the assumption that the universe at the moment is contracting everywhere at a certain minimum rate everywhere, then it's unavoidable that all geodesics will come to a singularity at a finite amount of time. And you can calculate what the maximum amount of time is at C third. So that would be a Big Crunch. Okay, so the conclusion is that the equation that we derived implies that theta inverse must go to zero for sufficiently early tau. We have therefore that the expansion goes to infinity, that would be a Big Bang. Also, for sufficiently late tau, in the case of a shrinking universe, we would have that the expansion goes to minus infinity, which would mean a Big Crunch. This type of reasoning also leads to other cosmological singularity theorems. So in particular, it is possible to avoid the assumption of global hyperbolicity, which would be nice, because according to classical general relativity, we probably have black holes with actual singularities in the universe. So we could allow then for the existence of some singularities elsewhere in the universe. And then under these weaker assumptions, when we drop the assumption of global hyperbolicity, then also the conclusion is a little weaker. And the conclusion in this case is not that every curve in the past must lead to a singularity, but at least one incomplete time-like geodesic towards the past exists. Right. So now, all of this does not mean that the universe necessarily had a Big Bang singularity. Of course, quantum theory could avoid it somehow. And it could also be that the strong energy condition doesn't hold. In fact, the evidence is that in the future, I mean, already now, the W parameter is about -1. And it might even be smaller than minus one. And that's just this end of the time scale towards the future. But in the past too, we know that there's strong evidence that the inflaton field provided the equivalent of a temporary cosmological constant which drove the W parameter to close to minus one, which means that the strong energy condition was violated during the inflationary phase of the universe. Now, this doesn't exclude that before the inflationary phase of the universe, we might have had a Big Bang that led to it. But we have no evidence either way, because we really don't know what happened before inflation. We can basically calculate to the end of inflation, through inflation, to the horizon crossing of the individual, the Hubble horizon crossing of the individual modes that we observe now. But we don't really have any experimental access yet, at least, to the beginning of inflation, and much less to what might have been before. But then these singularity theorems are still important, because they tell us that classical general relativity predicts singularities, in this case a cosmological singularity, but similarly also black hole singularities, not just because we assume high symmetry when we calculate exact solutions. But these singularities are unavoidable, classically at least, under relatively weak assumptions. In cosmology, we might, it looks like we get out of these assumptions. Strong energy condition may well be violated even before inflation, even though it should be said that then it was inflation too, because the violation of the strong energy condition is essentially the condition that, the strong energy condition is the condition that there was no inflation. The only extra thing you need there is isotropy and homogeneity. In the case of isotropy and homogeneity, the strong energy condition is exactly as we derived on the board, is exactly this, the condition of no inflation. But in the case of black holes, for example, singularity theorems are pretty convincing evidence that black holes really do form. It's quite unavoidable that black holes really form. Whether then actually singularity happens at the center of them, we don't know. That may well be protected by quantum mechanics somehow. But that black holes form in the first place is pretty unavoidable, even though there is going to be an angular momentum barrier. And you remember the argument of the figure skater that, you know, when she pulls her arms in, rotates much faster, that does not prevent the formation of black holes, just like it doesn't prevent the formation of a Big Bang singularity. Right. So that's as far as we go with the singularity theorem. Okay. Any questions? Okay. See you on Friday.